Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
So what we're doing today, we've listened a lot to lots of figures, lots of facts, lots of kind of the hierarchical strategies. And what we would really like to do, if you don't mind, is go right back down to basics. Is that okay?
And we want you to participate. It's the end of the day. We know you're all a little bit weary, but we're going to try and get the grey cells ticking over a little bit so that you can get up and move around. Hence the wonderful array here.
Which hasn't quite worked as we would have liked.
Due to the lack of surfaces. But anyway, you know, okay. We're nurses, we can adapt.
We can do that. Okay, so what we were looking at, obviously just recently we've had the Francis report. We all know about it. We all have quality standards that we have to adhere to. So what we're kind of doing is trying to pick out those key points. I'm going to give you a little bit of background about what happened to me in my role. Let's say we get caught out easily enough, if you look hard enough. And so what we wanted to say was, how are we going to prove that we are actually giving a quality service? So how do we know? How can we sit in our offices or on the ward and actually know that what we're saying we're doing, we actually are? Okay? So this is what we're going to try and talk about this afternoon. So, speaks for itself. Can any of us really and truly say, hand on heart, that we are delivering quality care? And I thought we were. And I got caught out a little bit. Nothing hugely drastic, but just very obvious that what I thought was happening, even though I was actually working 2 days on a ward, wasn't necessarily true. So is it any surprise that when we do get measured, we do get checked, when we do our own inspections, that we're found to be wanting in some areas? And certainly, in my experience, it was about documentation. Because I was only supernumerary on the ward area, I wasn't actually writing in care plans. I wasn't checking the documentation as I could have been. And when we looked very much harder and deeper and drilled down, it wasn't being carried out to the point that somebody could actually come along and say, I know that patient. That hit hard. That hurt. So what we're doing now is actually trying to work out, how can we prove that we're giving individualised care? So how do we know that the patient on that documentation is that patient in that room? What makes them different to the patient in the room next to them? And that's what we kind of found.
And I think as well, when we're working in a team with colleagues that we perhaps have worked with for a number of years, there's a general level of trust and assumption, isn't there? And I think what's become apparent is that actually it's dangerous to assume standards that by our own measures we assume are being met and delivered. The reality very often is somewhat different. And when you get a CQC inspection or whoever coming in to look at your organisation, how do you actually demonstrate that? And it may be that your organisation is doing that, but if it's not documented, it didn't happen. And I think that's been quite a revelation, not just for us, but speaking with colleagues within my own network, I think that's been quite a revelation for many of us, really. And the acknowledgement that we're all very vulnerable. And unfortunately, in the day and age that we live in, we have to be able to demonstrate in a clear and accountable way that what we're saying is what we're doing. Or what we're doing is what we're saying, whichever way round you want to look at it. You've got to have the evidence base there.
Do feel free to ask questions or interrupt at any time.
Everybody's okay. Nodding. Yeah. So if you've got something to add, please, come on, make this interactive.
So is it about being qualified? Is it about basic care? Is it a combination of both? We want perfect, we want gold standard, don't we? And that's what we're all supposed to be working towards. So let's do it. Let's have a look and see some of the key findings and key standards that actually have come from so many different places. We know all about them now, don't we? That we're experts in what we should be doing, what we hope we're doing. So what exactly are we looking at? So is the patient more important than anybody else? Certainly from my point of view. Are we all nurses here? Is there anybody that's not nurse?
Doctor.
Ah, well, hey. Well, then you're one of us, I'm afraid. So we do care, don't we? We do care about our patients more than anything else. Do we big up good stuff and kind of perhaps not look so closely at the bad stuff? Depends. You know, I work very closely with a governance manager who came into post only a couple of weeks before me. Oh, she's hard. She's so hard. But my goodness me, it's found things that you wouldn't imagine you would find. Certainly as a nurse, I wouldn't have been looking for. And with her supporting my role in quality, it's been a revelation. It really has.
I think it's a reflection as well of the culture that we're living in that's changing, and things that maybe were acceptable before or were accepted as reasonable practice are now not quite seen in the same light.
And it's all about what you keep in your head and what you can actually demonstrate. So, saying that we don't know what's going on, could that be happening where you're from? You know, how much do you know until you actually look really hard? What is happening? What if you went into your organisation at any time of the day or night and looked at one particular item, would that be a gold standard? We have a thing about the office door being closed if there's no staff in there. How many times have I closed that door? Honestly, you know, because that's usual practice. So it's trying to, well, my line manager always says it's not like turning a yacht, it's actually like turning a liner. It's just gently but firmly changing the culture. Okay, so don't rock the boat, so to speak. Good analogy. I was a bit confused about the last one until my corporate friend told me that it was a risk of disruptive loss of corporate memory and focus. So I didn't really understand what that meant when I read it in the Francis report, but what, in layman's terms, I suppose, is that there is so much change going on that we actually forget where we were a long time ago and what's happened in the past. We tend to forget that and move forward at an ever-increasing pace, and we've got to sometimes go back and think, well, where were we, and, you know, what are we learning from that, and take that forward. Okay, let common sense prevail. So, of course, our whole point is to put the patient first. I mean, there's no argument there, is there? And we don't want any breaching or put under the carpet of any of our standards and values that we know we must meet. And not just because we're told to do so, but because that's pride and that's good practice, isn't it? It's gold standard. We need to be working towards a competent crew. So we need to know that the people that are giving our patients care actually are able to do so. It's about being open and transparent. So everybody should know exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it, not just doing it because that's what they've been told to do. And make sure that the regulator is understood as being our friend and maintaining standards rather than the enemy.
I think it's difficult in the current culture that we're working in, where we feel so intensely scrutinised. You know, the media, the portrayal, the press. Nurses are feeling pretty got at, and the medical profession, I think, in general. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's always good to be challenged. But the trouble is, for some of us, that creates a culture of mistrust, and people feel that they're being picked on or, you know, they're under scrutiny for their individual practices, rather than, as you say, seeing it as a professional accountability issue, and that we have to be able to demonstrate what we say we're doing.
So it is the accountability and the responsibility of the provider. It's everybody's responsibility to make sure that we've got an informed workforce. You know, this is not a standalone. This is about everybody singing from the same songbook and wanting the best for our patients. So, patients, not numbers, count. I mean, this is what Francis found. This is about not just end-of-life care, but of course, you know, our focus is on end-of-life care, but this is just basic all-patient care, wherever they are and whoever's looking after them. And of course, we do need the backup of our finances. We do need to keep within our budgets as far as we possibly can, but it shouldn't compromise our patients. So my little bugbear, training, education, make sure that people know what they should be doing and make sure that they actually do that. We've had a big run on information governance. I don't know if that's your bugbear as well, but getting 100% compliance by the 31st of January, your group were fantastic.
Of course, 100%.
100%. But it's difficult. It's difficult to get, you know, every single member of staff in front of a computer, and information governance is not easy. But it's keep on banging away and eventually they'll do it. But it is knowing, making sure that your staff know what they should be doing and prioritising it. Everybody needs some kind of a plan. You know, we have printouts of what they need. We've got passports. We're working really hard to make sure. And we do offer the chance for people to do further education, but it's not always taken up as enthusiastically as I'd like. I mean, my colleague here is just wading through a master's, so I'm hoping she's going to be a champion for me to get other people enthused, because that's what we need.
I think one of the questions for me that the Francis report throws up, and generally, you know, looking at education and our own professional development in a different light, is how are we as a profession going to demonstrate our compliance? You know, it's not just always about a tick box exercise, is it? You know, you get your annual printout, if you like, of your education needs and your mandatory training. That's very much a paper exercise. But if the CQC were coming in to talk to you, or going into a nursing home, for example, I think the challenge for organisations is going to be, how are they able to demonstrate this level of compliance? How are they going to be able to demonstrate that educational development that our staff need to undertake, and us included? So maybe there might be work that we need to be a little bit more diligent about our portfolios, that we perhaps, you know, need to be keeping reflective diaries as a matter of course, so that if the CQC came in, for example, and with my particular team did a spot check on one of my diary and said, what happened on this day, I can actually demonstrate by my evidence that I did do what I say I did. But also, they may then want to go and see that patient. They might want to arrange a visit to go and talk to that patient about the level of care, the outcomes, were they satisfied? And I think that is a reality of the world that we're now living in. So I think we do have to give mind to how we actually demonstrate that educational development, and how we demonstrate our professional accountability, rather than just as a tick box on the paper. The quality of our notes, what we include, how we include it, the whole documentation process that we use, is it meeting all the standards that we should be? Is it looking at the holistic assessment document? Is it meeting the guidelines? But also, for me, it's that step further. Rather than just the paperwork, it's about the professional interaction on the coalface, if you like. And the patient feedback, I think, is going to become increasingly a part of that.
Yeah. And having good role models, people to work alongside, so that you actually are getting the learning on the shop floor as well, so to speak. It's not just about going on a computer and doing an e-learning course. It's about actually learning on the job. And that's, again, something you can put in your portfolios. It's so important to make sure that we're giving information to people that then will be looking after us in the end, you know, at the end of the day. That's what's going to happen. They will be, you know, we need to be training these people up, because they will be in charge of us at some stage.
And I think, you know, I speak personally here. I've recently gone through loss of my parent and nursing them at home with dementia, and relying on care services. And I thought I knew how the system worked. It was quite a revelation to me. And even with the knowledge base that I have and knowing what I know, the challenges and the battles I had to access appropriate care for my father. And we're all consumers. We think of ourselves as just the caregivers, but we're not. We're the consumers as well, and we might be on the receiving end one day.
So what we're saying in the last point there is about sharing and publishing. And this kind of thing, isn't it? This is about sharing information, gaining information. It's about audit. It's about checking and rechecking, making sure what you're saying you're delivering, you're actually delivering. And sometimes it's quite painful and very annoying to people that you go and sit down in an office and check documentation, you check medicine charts. And, you know, all the kind of things that you do every day. how would I feel if someone was doing it to my documentation? It's, you know, it can be quite tricky, but it's just trying to explain, you know, this is what we have to do, and hopefully over time people will actually do things automatically rather than having to be reminded, like the office door. Okay. Says it all, really, doesn't it? Is not communication the most important thing? You know, what do you actually need anything else? I think communication is top, and it's the one thing that we fall down on quite badly at times.
And this has been very much evidenced today from what our speakers have been saying, you know, talking about the issues around communication, about integrated working, joined up thinking and so forth, and coordination of care. You know, you can't provide consistency of care if you haven't got adequate communication. And for me, it's a no-brainer that it's the basis for all good healthcare. Whether you're talking end of life or generalist care, if we can't communicate effectively as healthcare professionals, then how on earth are we going to care adequately for our patients? And we've all been on the receiving end and witnessed too often, I'm sure, when communication has gone askew and awry, and how that's then impacted. It sets that domino effect off, doesn't it? That once you've lost that confidence of that patient, it's really difficult, or the family, to gain their trust back again. And I get frequent comments, you know, by relatives who will say to me, for example, let's just think of a, you know, where somebody's had bad news broken to them badly, and I always remember one patient's husband saying to me, do you know, Dee, that was just completely devastating. She was told on her own, and basically that undid everything that had happened beforehand. All that good work was lost because at that point in time my trust was shattered. And so it's really difficult then, isn't it, to make up that lost ground.
Okay, so...
Do you think that it's not just communicating, it's actually getting people to reflect back what they've actually understood? Because you communicate with people that they don't always understand.
And I think you're absolutely right, and especially in breaking bad news, and certainly with cancer, it's the focus on, as soon as they hear the word cancer...
They just hear the snippets, don't they?
Yeah. So you're quite right, reflecting back. Or trying to encourage them to have someone with them, I think, because you need that other person sometimes to just kind of reinforce what was said in the whole conversation rather than just those bits that they hear.
And I think, too, we need to reflect that in the documentation. How many times have you read a set of notes that said, spoke with patient, bad news discussed, given bad diagnosis? That doesn't really tell you anything, does it? You need to pinpoint the contents of that conversation, what was said, and how that actually progressed sequentially, so that it's a comprehensive picture, not just a nebulous statement, really. Sorry.
My name's Lawrence Perry. I'm a clinical lead nurse with Marie Curie. I'm quite new in the job. I only joined them in November. Now, I'm coming from a district nurse background. I work for...
Hi. Okay, my name's Lawrence Perry. I'm a clinical lead nurse with Marie Curie. I joined them in November, Guy Fawkes Day. So I've got a background. I've been a district nurse. In the trust that I worked in the PCT, none of the nurses got clinical supervision in the last 3 years. Mm. Now, clinical supervision, Marie Curie are bringing in as mandatory from March. It's very important that nurses know how to, obviously, as you said, communicate and to hear stories from other nurses of critical incidents that haven't gone well.
Yeah.
And it's obviously, when we're dealing with bereavement, some of our staff may in their personal lives be dealing, as you said, in your own situation with parents with dementia. I've been there, I understand. So I think that obviously we're dealing with a workforce of individuals, of nurses, of healthcare assistants, and we need to bring
across the best way.
Put your microphones off.
I could raise my voice. I haven't actually communicated well on a number of occasions. I've learned from my peer set, from the people that I work with, from reading articles, and obviously this communication, as you said, breaking bad news or something, it can be misinterpreted by the individuals. We can come across a range of events where somebody else will say, and I had it. I was working within the health service. I booked Marie Curie nurses, and I was told I was only allowed to use them in the last 10 days of life, of the patient's life.
So
this patient had longer to live. And therefore, I had, oh, you can do it. You have to cap the nurses, or you have to cap this.
So what do you think would have been the answer to that, though? What would have helped in your situation?
Well, a lot of people said, you should do this, or whatever. You should stop that. The palliative care consultant, in this case, had phoned me up and had told me that I had to drop the service. I had a number of people, but I should have got it in writing. My mistake is that I should have got an instruction, not verbally, but in writing.
Okay.
So the thought is that if you're working on the shop floor, as it is, you need to cover yourself, yeah. As you're perfectly right, it's good documentation, yeah. And for your workforce, clinical supervision amongst your staff is very important.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that when you talk about clinical supervision, we all do it very much informally, don't we, as well, without actually recognising it as being clinical supervision. If you come back into the office and you're working with a team of colleagues, you'll very often sort of, well, offload, if you like, or talk something through. Or actually, one of my favourite phrases, do you think I'm being unreasonable? You know, I think we all have to question our own practice at some time, and whether we acknowledge that as being formal or informal clinical supervision, it's still very valuable that we actually do that. And many, many organisations actually make clinical supervision now integral to a healthy function, if you like, of the team, which I appreciate in the current financial climate may be a challenge in terms of getting that funded, but nevertheless, I don't think you should underestimate your own informal clinical supervision either.
Well, I mean group clinical supervision. Mm. Group clinical supervision works.
Yeah, but
very
you might
well.
Do that as a team as well, mightn't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for that.
Okay, so just following on the theme, making sure that when things do go wrong, that we write it down, we action it, we learn lessons from it, and which is where clinical supervision, we're very lucky actually that we do have our clinical psychologist that will debrief sessions for us. We have bereavement counsellors. We do have an opportunity to talk things over, and we do get together in a group and go through lessons learnt and make sure that things that have been issues don't reoccur, and you know, steps we can take as a team to address them. So it's being open, honest and transparent basically all the way through, isn't it? Act upon reported outcomes. So again, if you're doing audits, there's no point just doing an audit and then putting it in a file. If you do an audit, learn from it. I mean, if it's perfect, that's great. If it's perfect every time, then you need to change it. So it's making sure that what you find, that you actually do something about. And if you're doing it brilliantly, move on to something else. And I think I'll let you do the last point.
I was talking with Penny about this and remembering a very dear colleague and friend of mine who retired. And, you know, sometimes in life people say things that stick with you for one reason or another. And he used to say, never assume, because it makes an arse of you. And actually, that's one thing that throughout my career in palliative care I have kind of stuck to. And I do remember Jim with great fondness. I'm sure he wouldn't mind me sharing that with you. One of his words of wisdom. But it's very true. We, as we said just now, you know, we all very often assume, don't we, that our colleagues are doing what we think they're doing. And they might well be. But where's the evidence? How do we demonstrate that?
Okay. So, can
stretch
we get you to do
time.
A bit of work? I've got loads of little post-its here.
There's little piles all the way along here.
Would you be able to write a key phrase or a key word and stick on one of each of the bits of paper? Just so that we can tell how you are going to evidence how you're going to
And what we've done here is taken the common themes that we all come across in everyday practice and really have been reinforced very much by the Francis report. So I suppose the question to ask yourself is, how do you want your organisation to look? That's the question we're asking in each of these sort of areas. You know, go back to your basics. Think about how you can evidence this within your own organisation and some of the bits that jump out at you. And if you'd like to write them on a post-it and stick them under the different headings as to how you think this might be demonstrated, then we can perhaps just quickly reflect back on them and share them with one another and perhaps look at ways that we can take this away and share from it. Yeah, sure. Okay, so there's a common theme as I'm looking across these already that's emerging, I think. If we start off this way and work across, we've got individualised care here, which obviously Francis report focuses on very, very acutely, doesn't it? And we like to think we're all doing it. Clearly, taking the time to talk to patients and family and carers about what they need, what their needs are. And I think in that, I'd say also about documenting sometimes the patient's agenda may be very different from the carer's agenda. And I think we, you know, the theme that seems to be emerging here for me is there's a big issue around documentation and how we record this, how we assess it, that we use incredible tools, but also we're demonstrating our own communication skills within this and not just going for the obvious. You know, what do you think your needs are? That's a very broad question. Sometimes we need to guide the patient along the right pathway in terms of assessing what each of those needs might be. Obviously, asking the patient, how many times do families speak for patients without checking with them? Comprehensive assessment, including conversation contents, goes back to what we were talking about earlier, not just had a discussion about end-of-life care. No decision about me without me. Words. It's just powerful words, isn't it, really? And we all like to think that we're doing this, but as I say, for me, the message that seems to have come out of a lot of this was that we're not very good at evidencing it.
Can I just say,
yes.
I actually manage a nursing home for people with very advanced forms of dementia, early onset dementias, and by the time they come to us, we very often can't ask them. We cannot have a conversation with them because, you know, there's nothing
they don't
there
have
whatsoever.
The capacity,
So for us, it's very important, is the life histories and it's the relatives. So for us, we have to evidence that very clearly when we're inspected. Because the first thing they ask us is, have you asked the patient? Have you asked the resident? Have you spoken to them? And you think, you're from the commission. It clearly states in all my documentation that our residents have got very advanced forms of dementia. Yes. I can't ask them very, very often. And that's very frustrating.
I'm assured by the CQC that they are now taking, if you like, experts in particular areas of care with them when they're doing inspections.
Are they?
They've started to acknowledge that this is, you know, if you like, something they need to work with and identify. And clearly, you know, somebody who may be going in to do an inspection, you don't know what you don't know.
No.
And so if you've got somebody who's got an inkling of what you might know, and I've certainly, you know, we have a number of care homes that deal with patients with advanced dementia, and, you know, the photo albums and the life history sort of, you know, that you can sort of engage with some of the patients. I appreciate not all of them are able to, but those are very powerful evidence, aren't they, in terms of the patient's life and their history that help to support the choices that are made.
It's very important. And also the other thing that the commission need to get a grip with is the fact that my residents are in their 40s and 50s. So when they come to us, they treat them as if they're in their 70s and 80s, because they think that's where the dementia is and that's where they've got their experience from. And they don't realise that the care we deliver is actually very, very different, because we don't focus on reminiscence therapy very often. We don't look in the 60s and the 40s and whatever. You know, we're looking at things that are very, very different, and we're looking at it from a completely different point of view. So getting someone to come and see us that is an expert in that field as well, that would make our life 10 times more
10 times easier,
yes,
because the level of explanation that we would have to give would be completely different.
Yeah.
Because a lot of it is about justification all the time, because these people don't actually know.
But it's also then about empowering your staff who may be, as you say, having to justify their, yes, decisions and their practices.
It's they're also very good at doing that.
And that's I think, is the key to success in some, yes, of this, that in some organisations I've been in, the care staff aren't able to verbalise particularly well what their evidence is and how they're justifying their actions. And that's where very often organisations, I think, fall down.
Yes.
But also for our patients, and this is what it's about, isn't it? It's about the people that we're caring for, that we're fulfilling their wishes. And my benchmark has been and always will be, how would I want that to be if that were my mother or my father?
Yes, I would agree, yes.
Reading carer's notes can be quite illuminating.
Oh, very much.
Yes, yes. I found that out to my own experience. So we've got physical and psychological needs. What have we got here? We've got emotional support and follow-up, reflective diary, holistic assessment. I think I can't quite read that word. Something on regular review.
Review with standard tool.
So the symptom assessment scale.
Yep.
Holistic needs assessment documented, and there's some really good work that's been done in Northern Ireland. I don't know if anybody's read any of the stuff that they've done there in terms of their holistic assessment document, where they've integrated with social care as well. That's a, you know, if you get the chance to look at it, I highly recommend it. It's very comprehensive. There's no way you're going to get that done in one fell swoop. It's going to take several attempts at that. Again, we're talking about documentation, the use of just pain charts, but body charts as well in terms of mapping. Liaison with psychologist and psychiatrist. And again, it's about evidencing those conversations and the contents of those conversations, I think, isn't it? Mm. Are the service pathways referral routes to address both sets of patients' needs? And I think that's a really valid point, isn't it? We can't encompass it in one heading. The physical and the psychological are two very different assessments in their own right. And it goes back to what we were saying as well about the patient's perceptions. And so how we evidence that again. Accurate and appropriate information. Wow. liaising closely with GPs and healthcare professionals, liaison with MDT teams, and I think that's really important that we evidence the MDT decisions, if we can generate the documents from the MDT in terms of decisions that are made. Certainly in my role, clinicians, and rightly so, want the evidence of the MDT decision, because it guides you in your care, doesn't it, and what you do. Robust communication across primary and secondary care. And I think, for me, that's evidenced every day in terms of where you have those good links, certainly between primary and secondary and tertiary care even, make working relationships much easier. But on that, you then build trust. And if you can build that trust, then I think you get far more cohesive integration of care. Use national initiatives such as the information prescription. Yeah, and I think sometimes it's about signposting our patients and carers as well. We've recently developed a sort of an information service in our new centre. And again, it's about putting people in the right direction to find out what they need. You might not know the answers, but you can recommend perhaps some useful tools or reliable websites. Assessment, joined up communication. Have patients and carers found information of any benefit? What do they need? What needs to be changed? And I think, and somebody's put here, information leaflets offered after a discussion with the patient's carer's family. And I think that's a really valuable point. One thing that I've learned from my colleagues in the information service is that I think one's perception generally, isn't it, about information, is that you've just got this raft of of leaflets on display. Well, how do you know what you need? I think it's really important that you engage in that conversation and then dovetail those patients' or carers' or families' needs in the right direction. Otherwise, they're just absolutely barraged by this dearth of information, and how do they make sense of it? So that's, again, where there's a theme emerging here, isn't there? Support independence and social participation, portfolios, activity teams, therapies. I think involving complementary art therapies, occupational therapies, wider members of the multidisciplinary team to enable people to stay in their own home and be clear in our goal setting with our patients about what their expectations are and what their evidence is for that, and if it's sustainable, I guess. Spiritual wellness and emotional support. Patients' values and beliefs are documented. That's just so important. Signposting. Check how we support, I think that says. Assess and document patients' preferred spiritual preferences. Communication, ask the patient, family, carers, certainly in terms of chaplaincy, or if they have any spiritual needs, because generally, when you talk to somebody about spiritual needs, they associate it with religion, don't they? And I think we need to be clear with people. It isn't just about that. Religious services, in-house communion, one-to-one with religious leaders. I found our chaplaincy service quite a mine of information, really. It's he's just an amazing guy. And I think I've looked at spiritual well-being in a slightly different light. But also, what I think traditionally hasn't happened, and again, it comes back to our documentation and our evidence base, is that we don't necessarily ask our colleagues in the chaplaincy service to document in the notes about important conversations that they may have had that might be, you know, quite personal, but we need to seek the patient's permission sometimes to share that, and obviously they're the best person to judge that. But I think we have to be respectful of their input and value it too. Advanced care planning, gosh. Well, we've got DNA CPR, patient choices being documented, effective communication amongst the team, clear documentation, care plans, social histories. Think about mental capacity. Yeah, absolutely. Whether or not there's a safeguarding issue, of course, is something that we all come across. Gold standards, framework meetings, discussion with family and residents first, GP information, giving information to relatives. And I think within that, we have to have a mindliness that we need the patient's permission to share what they're sharing with us and not assume that we can share it with the family.
And also it's about trying to, if somebody has that conversation, to capture it there and then, rather than have to keep revisiting it every time a new set of notes, a new person goes to the patient, because it must be get very tedious to be asked over and over again the same questions when it's a very sensitive subject. So my plea is, if it's mentioned, write it down.
One thing that we are adopting in our notes, and we've come to the conclusion that within documentation, we want this to be a contemporaneous record. You know, this is a journey for a patient and their family, and we want it to be documented as such. But I think one thing that can become quite problematic for healthcare professionals in amongst all that plethora of information is picking out important and key points. So what we've decided to adopt is a highlighting system, whereby if there's something key and pertinent that is important, we're just, you know, highlighting a few words in green, for example. If there's a clear treatment decision or a medication change that's something of real importance, if you like, we're highlighting it in pink. So as you actually read through the document, you can sort of, if you like, skim over the less important areas as to what their bowel movements may have been, which could be very important to them, but it might not be relevant to the conversation that you're having at that moment when you're trying to pinpoint perhaps what's happened with a scan result or a medication change or a difficult conversation around resuscitation, for example. And I think the other thing that we've got recording of conversations and liaisons with GPs, district nurses, etc. One thing, I don't know if any of you do this, but one thing that I do is think about the evidence that I'm documenting. It's not just about my written word as in the notes, but if I email a GP that I have a response from them, or even if I don't, most of the time I'm pretty fortunate I do, but I print off that email and I actually put that in the notes as well, and I might just cross-reference it with C email, because again, that's part of your evidence, isn't it? Out of hours. Does anybody use out of hours handover forms for their doctor service? I mean, those can be really valuable. Have you found them to be so?
I think it's helpful when...
I think they're very helpful when you use them properly.
Yes.
I think they have to be filled in with the right amount of information. Mm. And some of them we see coming from GPs to the out of hours service will just say that somebody's got cancer and is on the end of life register. Whereas what you actually need to include is what their wishes are about preferred place of care.
Yes.
Do they have an ADRT? Do they have a lasting power of attorney?
Yes.
So if they're completed correctly, then they're a good guidance for the out of hours
yeah.
service.
Mm.
But you've got to take the time to put that information into them.
And I think GP systems are getting better, aren't they, at generating and cross-referencing those things on documentation that's used, which does then make it a far less laborious process in terms of repetition. I think make something earlier in disease journey, as it is for neurological conditions, make routine. I can't quite read that word, but something about appropriateness of the journey, I suppose, really, about getting in at a timely point rather than in a crisis and trying to build up a relationship. And obviously... recording patients' future wishes, whether they be around, as you say, advanced decisions to refuse treatment or resuscitation or after-death wishes, for example, if they have any particular spiritual beliefs. Penny, over to you.
Yeah, support and awareness of carers, to wrap it up, really, because they are the support, aren't they? They're the ones that are there afterwards and need input. Some do, some don't. It's very individual, isn't it? What have we got here? So have any carers had an assessment of their own? That's quite a broad subject, really, isn't it? I mean, does the carer need caring for themselves? Are they able psychologically to support themselves or the person that they may be losing? You know, do we have a good system in place? I think most people probably have, but it's actually reminding ourselves that they do need help as well. Trying to keep the patient at home as long as possible. Again, a bit of a double-edged sword, because sometimes a relative can't cope with someone at home. We had one recently that actually the carer didn't want the patient to stay at home because they didn't want that person to have died in the house for their young daughter. It would have been too upsetting. And that was something so unusual that, you know, it caught us quite by surprise and had to rethink really how we dealt with that. We got here. Of what benefit to carers are planned action interventions? Have they got all the information they need, really, I suppose?
Mm-hmm.
Are there training support? Is there any training support? That's a really valid point, actually.
Mm.
Is there training out there for them to be able to manage? So say, for instance, we had a teaching session yesterday on NIPI. Do the carers know how to use it, and how rigorous is our system to actually put that into place as soon as possible to get that patient back home or to keep them in the home as long as possible?
But it's
really
also about
point.
Documenting. You know,
yeah,
I can think of a situation where recently I had to facilitate a carer training for a hoist, and it took an enormous amount of work going between various agencies trying to get somebody there to do it. But then obviously if you don't evidence that in the notes and something then happens to the patient, mm-hmm. Where would you stand in a court of law? So I think the overarching message that we'd like to leave our parting shot with you, if you like, is that through our own practice and our own experience, we just want to share with you that really I think it boils down to the communication and the documentation. And I think we just have to be mindful and look at our own organisations and the documentation that we're using. If it isn't fit for purpose, maybe you need to redesign it, but that you clearly demonstrate your evidence. And that we don't make assumptions about our colleagues, and that we're, I suppose, ahead of the game. And the reality is that we do have to think about what we do and how we do it. I won't say cover our backs, because that sounds, you know, a negative way of looking at it. But I think we do need to be mindful that without that being documented, if it doesn't make it to the paper in a comprehensive manner, then it didn't happen. And that then, when you come to look at issues around complaints or litigation, can be very difficult, very painful, not just for the patient and their relatives, if it's bereavement, but also for us as professionals, really.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your participation. That's very good of you.
Thank you for not dropping
off.
Thank
you for staying. Yes, thank you for staying awake. And
have a safe journey home.
See you next year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.